Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money, major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never change anything.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me. Show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. We'll be right back.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Do you all believe as a race, I'm not talking about you specifically, but do you believe as a race, African Americans, we play the victim?
Hey, man.
I have a dream.
No. I'm just going to leave that as a one-word answer. I'm not even going to jump in deeper than that. No.
Yeah, I'm on the side of absolutely not, and I will leave it there until somebody disagrees.
Yeah, then I'll jump back in. And now I'm gonna step back.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm gonna be real. I'm gonna say yes.
Let's go.
I'm gonna say yes.
Give me an example.
See, it's a loaded question just because I'm not going to sit here and say every single African-American sides either on the yes side or on the no side.
Mm-hmm.
I say yes to mainly spark conversation, but also I know you're not talking, you said not personal experiences, but that's all I got to go on. I will say, you know, just based on where I am in life, I've gotten a lot of pressure from African-Americans feeling like, you know, I've gotten to where I am because of white people, or you didn't grow up like I did. Like, I came from the hood, you know, I didn't have the same opportunities and privileges that other people had. And though, you know, I believe that to be true, in today's America, I really do feel like anybody has the opportunity to rise to the occasion. Now, is it easier for certain people over others? Yeah. I mean, let's be real. Yes. Like, that's 100% true. But, you know, I just keep hearing, like, systemic oppression, this, that, and the third. Like, yeah, we get it. I know. Like, we all know. but the opportunities are still there. Will you have to work a little bit harder to get to where you want to be? Absolutely. Because of how you look? Absolutely. I'm a testament of it. Anybody gonna say nothing? I want to hear this.
I think it's impossible to accuse us of playing the victim. You're talking about a 400-plus year head start for a particular set of people. You're talking about systematic oppression. That's what I meant by a post-traumatic state. Is we're at this stage in 2020. We're trained to say, yeah, it's unequal, but and that's just not okay to me. I don't think we should ever get to the place where we just accept inequality.
Correct.
I'm not encouraging stagnation, so I agree with you. I'm not encouraging throwing in the towel like, yo, it's not fair. That's not what I'm saying at all. But while striving to be your best self, you should never accept inequality. And I think that's what we're being trained to kind of just be like, yo, this is just the way it is, and to no longer call it out. And I'm not even saying we got to go picket, protest. I'm not saying none of that. But at least in conversations like this, if we're not going to set a standard, no standard is going to be set. Nobody else is going to stand it. Nobody else is going to set it. You're talking about, statistically, like factually speaking, at the onset of the 20th century, you're talking about land owners only giving land to specific races. That's generational wealth.
Yeah.
You're talking about bank loans only being given to specific races.
How can you
that's generational wealth.
Correct.
So we can't it's not even like this is ancient history. That's what blows my mind. This is recent history.
But he didn't say that that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
What he said was, do we play the victim?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very different. You're aware of the things that have happened, but are you victimized as a result of it?
So,
do you say, this is what I can do with what I have been allotted or whatever my place in life is? Are we playing the victim is the question.
Well, I think we have to define play the victim.
Okay.
I think we are the victim.
Because anybody can be a victim.
I think we are factually a victim.
So all races can be victims.
So what do we call in playing the victim?
What do you see that as then?
What do I see what as?
Playing the victim, like when you hear that, like what does that trigger for
play,
you?
Play the victim means I'm acting like something is being done to me that's not being done
or
to me.
Or always complaining.
That's what I hear.
Always complaining about our history.
That's what I hear when I hear play the victim. Like you're taking the position that something being done to you and nothing's being done to you. That's somebody playing a victim to me.
This is what I
and
hear.
And that's not the case to me.
This
you know
is
what I mean?
I hear.
Yeah.
Get over slavery. Stop talking about it. We're all equal now. You should be ahead. You should be further than where you're at. Stop talking about the old days. I'm gonna stop right there.
Yeah,
that's what it triggers in my head.
Mm-hmm. So to say like we can't, I don't think you can outrule or like just say, hey, we're some black people aren't playing the victim because everyone uses excuses.
Correct.
And people can be playing the victim by whatever excuse they may bring. But like you said, and like you said, like we weren't given an opportunity basically to build that generational wealth, and without that opportunity, we don't own anything. So we are having to kind of look for employment like at wherever you work. And even you said there's one person at D1 that's black. And we're 15% of the nation. That's not an accurate representation of America. So therefore, we may not be playing the victim, but we're getting hurt in corporate America or wherever part of life.
Yeah, that's kind of just statistics. I'm going to agree with him. I also don't like the term playing the victim because it does sound like you're alluding to something that is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I'm not dismissing or negating the effects of 400 years of oppression.
Sure.
And, you know, the things that we've seen and been through. I'm not dismissing any of that. But if we cut it all off and we started with a year ago, we are still being victimized by the stuff you have to see on TV. You have African-American boys who at the age of 11 or 12, all they have ever seen were African-American boys being killed on TV.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they've ever seen. They've not known the life without it because they've watched this happen since they've been old enough to understand.
Mm-hmm.
They are victims. You can go into a grocery store. You can go into an amusement park. You can go anywhere and be mistreated, and you will be a victim today. We're not talking about the victimization only of the yesteryears. You can be a victim tomorrow. And I think if we're all honest, we have been in places where you have been the victim.
That's right.
You were either wrongly accused or wrongly criticized, or maybe let's not even make it a negative thing. Looked over for a job unjustly. It's happening. So you there's a rationale to the relevancy of still being victimized.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I was, to her point, it's not even like this is ancient history. We're talking about 1960s, 1970s, like the Civil Rights Act was just passed halfway through the 20th century. Like, it's not even hundreds of years ago. Like, there are people alive still, like, you know what I mean, who went through segregation that are still alive. Like, it's not even,
of course.
You know what I mean? It's not even ancient history. So I can never agree that the responsibility is on us to fix the mistakes of others. I could never agree with that. I just can't.
And it doesn't take away, you know, something that I said on the back end of my last answer. At some point, as a family, as a community, you can gather the people you love and say, let's get us out of
this.
And then you could say, well, we're no longer playing the victim. We took pride and took our own responsibility. And then you can build all that up, and tomorrow you can go somewhere and still be disrespected.
To that point, in my initial answer to you, I said I'm not making an excuse for stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not no excuse to be stagnant.
Yeah.
It's not no excuse to not grind and hustle and get out here and get it. But even if his question is about us as a race and as a culture,
mm-hmm.
and if I get my family together and pull my family up, that's my family.
Exactly.
You feel me?
That's
not balancing the scales.
That's right.
You know
and
what I'm saying?
It's very interesting. Your point is very, very interesting because I could be an extremely successful black man in today's America and still go somewhere tomorrow and be looked down upon because of what I look like.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, because I remember like Booker T. Washington, like the 1890s, to kind of offset the Jim Crow laws. He was
not
like,
saying
hey,
I'm that old, right? I'm not trying to give you some
you remember
factual.
Him, right?
Yeah. I didn't go. I'm the historian.
He said basically.
Is my gray showing that much, for real?
I was going to ask you this. So you said basically to offset the Jim Crow laws that were put in place, we had to educate and be entrepreneurs. And you two have both done that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear your experience, because this is, 130 years later for him saying, hey, we need to mobilize on our own, get education, and be entrepreneurs. And that will create our own system of wealth. But, I mean, you're only, like you say, you're only one person. It's hard to pull up a whole group.
Of course.
So I'd kind of like to hear y'all's experience as being entrepreneurs.
You can talk many
options. I was going to let you go first.
Simone owns her own shop, too, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Oh, okay.
I'm taking it in.
I'm sorry.
Listening right now.
Well, like I said, I was kind of raised in an entrepreneurial family, right? I was always taught, don't work. I'll just be honest, my father, don't work for the white man. That was it, right? You get education, anything you can take, put it towards your own business. Put your own 2 feet on the ground. Save your money. You know, get a hustle. You know, he's showing me all these things to do. So it was always in my mind that I had to work for myself. The only way I'm going to come up is to work for myself. So I was never trained to, you know, you're going to get a great education, then you're going to go get a great job, and then you're going to be successful, then you're going to raise a family. That was out. Go get your own brand. Raise your family. Give your brand to your family.
Mm.
Let them continue that generational wealth. So that's the way I was taught.
Mm.
And that's the way I got to keep it moving.
Okay.
Rephrase the question that you had specifically.
Basically, what I was saying is Booker T. Washington said to offset any type of segregation or discrimination or from playing the victim, we need to educate and be entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Has that experience kind of help you push through, and have you been able to bring others up because of your entrepreneurship?
Okay, so thank you for that question. I definitely believe that entrepreneurship is freedom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's ultimate freedom. I was writing down a thought just yesterday as I was flying through Chicago that one sign of enslavement is a name change. That when people say that you're something that you're not. So if I was to like go and address the same idea with biblical characters. We could look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Mm-hmm.
That was not their name.
Yes.
It was their name that they were given in enslavement. And I can just imagine how they were in a room together and, you know, one of them yelled, "Hey, Shadrach, dude, that is not my name. I'm Toby." You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And I feel like we have a responsibility to know who we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a responsibility to do our due diligence to make our name great. That somebody can walk around and call you a liar. Is that who you are?
Yeah.
That's not who you are. Somebody can walk around and call you a thief. Is that who you are? That's the name that the enslavement has given you, right? And so I think that the only way that we can exercise true freedom is in ownership of our stuff, of ourselves, of our actions, of the things that we create, that we can be makers. I think that this is the time for all hustlers to unite, you know, that we all can make whatever we want to be a part of. We no longer have to sit back and say, oh, it's because of what you did to me. Listen, I was molested as a child. So if we want to go back and talk about victimization of the things that people have done to us, we can do that. Or we can rise above it and we can say, well, this is who I am now. This is what I'm going to do. When I started my business, I could not bake, not even out of a box. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any credit. I didn't have any experience in the business. Nobody was going to give me a loan for anything. I was losing the house that the very bakery exists in right now, 11 years later. Because when you put your mind, this is what I was saying earlier, we can be focused on what happened for us instead of what has happened to us. I believe that it is that blood running through my veins that had things taken from her. You know, it is that blood running through my veins that said, no, you can't come in here. It's that blood that is running through my veins that made my great-grandfather one of the first to be able to sing where he sang. And those are the things that I'm using today to get me from where I am to where it is that I want to be. And it's those things that I'm giving to my children and saying, this is what you have. We're not talking about what we're not. We're talking about what we are. Mm. And I think that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about what we are, what are we doing right as a culture that's setting up our children to have wealth? What are we doing right as a culture to where our children's children will know our names? Are we doing things right as a culture to change the narrative of our finances, of our children?
I can only answer that as an individual and then see what we and my wife also try to do and spread, right? You know, we're all about giving back. We're all about showing and proving. You know, I want to be that beacon that this young brother said, you know what? I want to do what he's doing. You know what I'm saying? I want to go out and get my own wealth. I want to start my own business. And if I wasn't there, maybe he didn't see me. Maybe they never came to my restaurant. Maybe it's just be, you know, but when you're there, we're going to teach you. We're going to give you tools. We're going to teach you about customer service. We're going to teach you how to run a restaurant because that's what we have to do. It's my duty. I have to teach. And again, I can only speak about me. I can't save the world. Yeah. But I can save the people that watch me. I can save the people that touch me. I can save the people that work for me. I do my best, right? You know, so, you know, I just look at it as you have to be that beacon, right? You got to be that shining light to change everything around you. You know, be that leading example.
But I don't think that's anything new under the sun, what you're saying.
No, it's not new.
I think that's what this community has been. You know, it has been a community of people who say, I'll teach you how to do this.
What community are you talking about?
The Black community. has gone, I have plenty of examples in my life of people who stuck their foot in the door so that I could pass through.
That's not always out the way we do things, though. You know.
Okay, today we're going to do a short and sweet live stream podcast. Today's podcast is titled Dry, and today on Mondays, it's this installment on Mondays we call the House Wren Society. We reserve Mondays for the House Wren Society. And what is the House Wren Society for those of you who do not know? Simple thing is, what's a house wren? A house wren is a bird, just a little bird, that everybody on the scene, practically everybody on the planet has seen at one time or another, or several times, matter of fact, daily, in most places around the world. But it's a little small bird, and before there's mating season, before the males and females get together to procreate to, you know, bring in the next generation of house wrens. The male house wren builds anywhere from 5 to 12 nests. They build the nests before there's any mating. Now, up to 12. Now, but that's just the first part of the process. The second part of the process is, well, you know, hold it. First part, he's got to find a territory to build. Then after he finds a territory to build, then he builds, you know, the 12 nests. Then, you know, he sings out, and that's how he attracts. The singing says, well, I got a nest ready for you to look at. All right. And then he takes the perspective female house wren around to the various nests, and she selects one. Now, she doesn't select any. If none of them are to her liking, she will not be mating with this particular house wren in that mating season. The mating systems for house wrens typically might range from, at least in the Western Hemisphere, from March to late early March to late August. All right. So if none are to her liking, but just that particular male house wren, it ain't gonna be no making love with those two. Now, so the house wren, and he's programmed. The house wren male is a builder. Okay, so they're pre-programmed. You know, this is what I got to do before I get the romance going. All right, so let's say she picks one out of the 12 or whatever, and then, you know, she does her part, but that's how they roll. That's how house wrens roll. So, and tomorrow we're going to get more into it, but anyway, so back to the day. Now, today's podcast is titled Dry Housing versus Wet Housing versus Hybrid Housing. A lot of people, well, many people, I'll put it that way, you need to know what you're living in. Particularly a person that might be facing foreclosure, eviction, or high living expenses. Housing is probably a big portion of that. So you need to know what type of housing or which is the appropriate technology of a house that you need to live in. Now, this is going to be short and sweet, and I'm going to give it to you, the distinctions between dry housing versus wet housing versus hybrid housing. A dry house is a house that has no running water. bathroom, as modern man in 2023 knows it. A dry house has no running water. It can have water, but it has no running water, no indoor plumbing. As, once again, as we know it in 2023. That's a dry house. All right? Now, if you go online, the closest you want to get to this is you type in the words in any search engine, dry cabin. But the mainstream world doesn't apply that, you know, to dry any house. But dry housing is any house that does not have running water, or in many cases, indoor plumbing. All right? Now, it's 2023, and if you look at the history of man, you've had more presidents of the United States, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Calvin Coolidge. None of these people, none of those presidents, people who helped form the nation of the United States of America, they lived in dry houses when they were young. Or their entire lives, they lived in dry houses. If you go to Mount Vernon, which is George Washington's estate in Mount Vernon, Virginia, I've been there two or three times. It's a good site. If you go to the DMV, which is the D.C. area, I highly suggest, you know, taking a trip to Mount Vernon, George Washington's estate. It's a pretty cool tour. But that whole, which is a plantation, and you go in George Washington's house and all that other kind of stuff, and no running, there was no, once again, no indoor plumbing. So for the you know, King James, you know, the guy who put together the King James Bible, no running plumbing. So for the history, so for what we know as plumbing today, okay, it's very, very contemporary. The majority of mankind so far, people who have been on this earth, never experienced indoor plumbing. They lived in what we would call dry housing. All right, and let's see, the closest thing you're going to get to that day, if you go on YouTube and type in dry cabin, now that's a term that's used in those circles, dry cabin, with off-the-grid people, and those are typically cabins and or houses that have no indoor plumbing. All right, now, wet housing, housing that has indoor plumbing and running water. The typical person that lives in the Western world, that's what they're familiar with. Some developing countries, there are a lot of people who don't have that. Even in the developed, I mean, like here in the United States, you do have people that still, by choice in many cases, that, you know what, we'll build a house or whatever, or a cabin, and it'll be a dry cabin because, you know, it's more economical. But, you know, people have adjusted to that lifestyle too. But wet housing is what typical Western people know. You have running water, you have indoor plumbing, which includes, a kitchen sink, a bathroom sink, running water, flush toilet, that type of thing. That's wet housing. So we got, and that's really it, dry housing and wet housing. Now, the third one is hybrid housing. Now, we can take the typical house today. All right. It's really a hybrid house. It can be useful for dry, as a dry place, as well as a wet. Now, Mignon Francois, when she had her utilities cut off, it went from a wet house to a dry house. And a lot of people freak out when the water is cut off and the electricity, well, let's say the plumbing, and you know, you can't, because they don't know anything about dry housing or the dry housing lifestyle, and then how to accommodate and what practical and easy alternatives that they have. But the typical house today could be, it's what I would consider a hybrid house. But it's only hybrid if you know how what to do if the water does get cut off, or, you know, you don't have to running water, mind you, because you can still have water to cook, to bathe, to flush your toilet. You just have it with an off-the-grid system. All right. Now, we'll have demonstrations on that offline as well as online later. Okay, so, you know, that tomorrow we're going to go through the top 10 causes of homelessness as well as the top 10 ways to prevent homelessness. But that's tomorrow. Anyway, let's see. Let's take a caller here. 773, your mic is open. 773, mic is open. Okay, you might be on mute. Okay, 773, going once. Your mic is open. Okay, well, they might have stepped away.
I'm here. I just had you on me. Sorry about that. Grand Rising.
Oh, okay. Grand Rising.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Really enlightened by that that audio clip that you shared. I would love to have groups of young people like that to speak at our conference that's coming up this Friday. We're going to be doing the conferences every quarter. We're going to have an event.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have Minister Robert Plump. I did speak with Naima. I shared on Naima's podcast, Naima Latif.
Okay.
The progress with the pallet. I still need help picking them up. I do need help with picking them up. And I realized because the model calls for like 500, so we might just do something small or something simpler, like with your original design. We still want to pick up the talents at least with the owner of the Grand Ballroom. And I did ask him if, you know, forcing a lot where I know nobody parks, if we could actually, or a steel container, if a steel container could be placed there, or if he's ever allowed someone to put materials there, you know, just to, you know, temporary hold. So,
okay.
Otherwise, donations are coming in. We got ad book donations and Little Johnny Ministries. That's our fiscal agent, so anyone needing a tax write-off, you'll write to checks out to Lil Johnny Ministries, LILJOHNNIE Ministries. I'll share the phone number, Brother L.A., 773-449-8839. Again, the number is 773-449-8839. I'd like to send a link from that number, text for a link to the website. Learn more. We are on Facebook. Black Youth Metropolis, this is the organization that we're raising funds for, and we are holding the event. The event will be held, so funding to hold the event is not the issue. We are holding our conference, but the build, we're so close, we were able to get the pallet. We are going to do the model that you spoke of. The idea was to do the build on Thursday, but we are at least going to film, picking up the materials and so forth. So the funding is available to do something. That $500 pallet tiny house is one thing. It's just a matter of getting the pallets to the site. I'm excited. We got a lot of young people. We got what Black Ice, our host, is calling Lil Beyonce. I'm saying Rihanna. I don't try to give Beyonce all that, but no, I like Rihanna as well. But this young lady, we did get her glossy, and she's going to be performing. So it's coming along. Coming along.
Okay, now do you have a team for your palette project?
Well, with the palette project, yes, but we're going to take two of the young men and build. We're gonna actually we're still gonna collect the palettes to do the palette, the model using palettes, but we're going to do something. Where it doesn't take too many trips right now. So we're going to start collecting the palettes, but keep in mind we're talking about 500 palettes for that particular design.
Oh, so you don't need 500 for that.
Well.
You don't need 500 palettes for, what's the square footage of what you're building?
Actually, let me see. We want to do the design I actually had two designs that we were looking at, but again, the issue is picking them up. So I'm going to take one truck and just pick up.
You probably need no more than about, at the extreme, no more than 100 pallets, which you'll probably be able to get away with. Matter of fact, if you just get, let's say, 70 pallets, and you probably won't even use all of them. But no, you don't need a whole lot. Now you're getting them. I'll ask you the price later on, or because you probably, if you know where to go, you can get a lot of that stuff free, or at a super cheap price. I would say no more than about 70. Like, so you got 70, 75 pallets, and you're not going to use all of them. You're not going to use it, more than likely. I would suggest start on something small, like something like 8x8, which is 64 square feet, and something bigger than no. At the extreme, the biggest thing would probably be 144 square feet, which is like 12x12. But yeah. From six, and those, both of those are big enough to hold two people. That's what I recommend. But I can call you this afternoon on that. All right. Well, that's the third, which is coming up here. That's what, Friday?
That's a Friday. Yes.
All right.
This is one community that built sticky homes for 60 individuals in 10 days using palettes.
You got a link on that? While we're on the air.
Yeah.
Let me look.
Palletshelter.com.
Hold it, Pallet Shelter. Okay.
And my company is called Pallet. Pallet is a public benefit corporation working to end unsheltered homelessness.
You said Pallet Shelter?
Mm-hmm. .com.
Okay.
Working to end unsheltered homelessness and give people a fair chance at employment.
Okay, you know, I'm familiar with this company a little bit, but the price they charge for their pallets is high.
Okay.
In my opinion, they want like $30,000 per hour.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, it looks like they're also putting the people to work too. Which is good. I believe in accountability. You know, just actually, 30,000 is pretty interesting because I hadn't read it yet. I just came across it while I was still researching some of the costs of the pallet. Infinity pallet, mm-hmm. Hardwood skid for the steel coil industry.
Okay.
They're mostly West Coast at the time being, yeah. And then to ship them, it can be kind of cost prohibitive. But this is a good guideline for us, though. Okay. Now I like the building materials that they have, but now we're using the name of their company is Pallet Shelter, but we'll be actually using real pallets.
Yeah. Yeah, the name of that company is Pallet. Over 225 pallet manufacturers, recyclers, and repair companies.
Mm-hmm.
A single source for all these pallets. Used and recycled pallets. Pallet buyback. You would think that they would have something like that for us. Because, you know.
All right, well, let's see. We'll pick back up on, I'll call you this afternoon on this. I got to find my studio again here. And I'm kind of multitasking offline, so.
No worries.
I don't want to burn up nothing. I'm cooking something. That's it. Okay, so you located a pallet place, and now you got to go pick them up.
Yeah.
Now have you got a team for that?
Yes, actually.
You need about maybe two people for that.
Yeah. Two of my young men just moved. Helped a young lady who has a not-for-profit called Kids Corner in Chicago. Ms. Williams, her husband, is a very popular house DJ. House is a culmination of, you could say, like, techno. Techno came after house, basically. But house music is really, like, disco music. And so he's pretty popular.
Okay.
And so we got that support from another not-for-profit. Little Johnny Ministries is our current fiscal agent. And Mr. Mayor will be our keynote speaker, but he's got a box truck, but it's in Milwaukee, so we have a resource as well, so we won't have to worry about renting.
Okay, wait a minute. You know what? Let me, I got you on the air. I'll tell you what. Okay, wait a minute. I'm gonna play Ballin' on Baltic, and then I'll get right back to you. So hold on. It should be starting now.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post. And the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change comes to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from Nuke State.
It's over. It's over. It's over.
And
I say it's over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police, like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old. And I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it. and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
All right, that was Ballin' on Baltic, and we shall be having this year offline game night. And on game night, we'll be playing one of two games. Monopoly, because you can learn. Matter of fact, you know, you can get rich off of Monopoly just by, that's why I play Ballin' on Baltic so much. The two least expensive lots to buy in the Monopoly game is Baltic and Mediterranean. Those are the first two lots on the board, and the color is purple. All right, before you build anything, as per the game instructions is, you buy the vacant lot. And instead of buying, now this is my twist on it, instead of buying a vacant city lot in a big metro area, buy a lot by the acre in a rural area. Or if you find a small town, you know, in a small rural town, that vacant lot might be an acre or 2 acres large or even 10 acres large or 20 acres large. But that's typically in your smaller, less densely populated rural areas of the United States. But that's your first move, and that's what I suggest people do. Now, so we'll have Monopoly game nights, and then there's another board game called Cash Flow, which is the brainchild of Robert Kiyosaki, who wrote the Rich Dad series and the Rich Dad Poor Dad book, the Cash Flow Quadrant, all those books. But so we'll have game night, and that's a good way to teach financial literacy. All right, today, like I said, the title of our podcast, and we covered it, is dry housing versus wet housing versus hybrid housing. Once again, it's real simple. Dry housing is housing that doesn't have any indoor plumbing. Okay, or very limited indoor plumbing. There have been more presidents of the United States who lived their entire life without indoor plumbing than there are presidents of the United States in contemporary times who all they know is indoor plumbing. You can go count up yourself. George Washington, no indoor plumbing. Thomas Jefferson, well, the indoor plumbing that they might have had was a chamber pot. So if they had to take a dump or pee, they do it in the chamber pot, and one of the servants or slaves would dispose of it. That was it for George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and all those dudes. You know, and I think it went probably even up to Calvin Coolidge when he was young, but there have been more presidents of the United States who knew nothing about indoor plumbing because it just wasn't available at that point. Dry plumbing. And if we look at the history of the world, dry plumbing, you know, dry housing. Now, in today's modern language now, you're not going to find what I'm talking about that term dry housing is the way I'm talking about. The closest you're going to get to it would be if you go on YouTube or any search engine and put in dry cabin, you know, it pops up, you know, quite frequently, like in places like Alaska. But that's a dry house. The history of mankind, including many people across the world today, their house is a dry house, meaning it has no indoor plumbing or very limited, well, if you call it chamber pot plumbing, but no indoor plumbing as we know it, no running water. Then there's a wet house. Now, that's what we, in Western countries, we know of today, where there is running water and an indoor toilet. Now, even in some of your Western countries, because I was over in Italy, and I never forget, we were on a road trip, so we started out in Germany, and we were you know, our destination was Italy, so we stopped off at a gas station, still on the road in Italy. And man, I'm glad I only had to do a number one. And I'm glad I was a man, because in the gas station, it was a clean bathroom, but they had a porcelain hole in the floor. So if you didn't have that skill set of knowing how to squat, and I'm glad there was nobody in front of me that messed up anything like that. And then another time, in another part of Italy, you know, I went into, it was a nice little ice cream shop, man. You know, European and all that, you know, the Italian flair with it. And went to use the restroom, and it had the same thing. So not all Western countries have flush toilet facilities. Okay. Anyway, but a wet house is typically has indoor plumbing and running water. And then there's the hybrid house. Now, let's take the United States. In the United States, the typical house that you're going to be in has, psychologically, people look at it as a wet house. It has indoor plumbing with running water. But what if your water gets shut off for whatever reason? Okay. And then people panic and they might have to go, no. All you need to do, and we'll have offline and online workshops on this, then your house can be converted into a hybrid house, because you can have water shipped in. You can have, instead of depending on municipal water, you can have your own water system that harvests, if you're allowed to harvest, rainwater. All right, and you can still shower. You can operate off of a gravity-fed system within your house. You can have a water pillow in an elevated area of your house, or even in the attic. So any house can be converted into a hybrid house where you can operate with water, with indoor or running water, or indoor plumbing, or so that's on the move. Okay, let's see. Friday, we have Family Capital. In other words, with Delmar America, and he'll be teaching you how to turn family wealth into paychecks. Matter of fact, on that, the audio I just played, Ballin' on Baltic, what is the family distinction? Let's take the Akbar family in the ghetto, or let's say in a black neighborhood. Well, you know, it can be any low income neighborhood, because they have more white and low income families than blacks. what's the distinction between the Akbar family, let's say Middle Easterners, who come in and they open up a convenience store in an all-black neighborhood, and a Chan family, let's say from Korea or Vietnam, they come over and they open up a Chinese food carryout in a black neighborhood. And the average Chinese carryout in the United States, this carryout takes in $1,100,000 a year. And it's basically family run. So what is, now I'm throwing this question out there right now. What's the distinction, and it's in plain sight distinction, that the Akbar family and the Chan family have, that somebody who lives in that neighborhood, matter of fact, the George Floyd family, George Floyd, it's interesting that the convenience store that George Floyd entered, and there was a, you know, a question about the, some, I guess the $20 bill that he handed over or whatever was counterfeit or whatever. But that family was the third generation was running that store. And the guy who runs that store said the only business that he's ever known or ever worked for is that family business in that convenience store. So let's say he represents the Akbar family. What's the in-your-face distinction between his family and the average family that might patronize this, or in George Floyd's family? And George, you know what? And George Floyd's family got a big payout. They got a big payout, but George is no longer here. 619-768-2945, you can point out the distinctions. If not, we'll just call it in early today. All right, Sevens, let's see, Reba, you there? I'm still back to you.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah. So make the announcement again, and then if you know the distinction between the George Floyd family and the people who own the convenience store, or anybody else who's listening.
Yeah, I apologize. You know, that Tyre Nichols young man is really interesting. What we're doing at Black Youth Metropolis and Inner City Youth, ICE, is our acronym, BYME, ICE by Me Productions, we're calling it. So we're saving young lives by restoring old cars. That's Mach 1. I guess it's short for machine.
Okay.
So,
You there? Oh, doggone it. I hit the...
I'm here.
I'm sorry, Reba. I hit the wrong button and muted you. I'm sorry.
Okay. So let's answer your question. First question, the event announcement.
Right.
This Friday, February 3rd, at the Grand Ballroom Chicago, located at 6351 South Cottage Grove. We're having... for the first part of the evening, we're having a youth conference from 5 to 7:30 p.m. And we have guest speakers and so forth out. We are looking to chime in and live stream with you, Brother L.A., so we're setting that up as well. If need be, we'll certainly still put you on the audio. But we are raising funds to build a tiny solar mobile cabin. The Black Youth Metropolis can be found online. You can Google Black Youth Metropolis, and the website link will pop up.
And then RebaLaMaestra.com is a link there as well. So we have a showcase of fine performing art talent. And myself, my live band is going to perform. I'm with Mix Company Band. And Tish Bailey will be performing as well with us. So we have other invited guests, sax preacher Minister Rahima Aston, and Black Ice, a poet, P-O-E-T, poet, people of extraordinary talent. He is our host. We have DJ Boomin Baker on the house track. He also does stepping music. He said, no. He said, look, just know I'm in high demand. That's DJ Boomin Baker. So we have old school versus new school. The Steppers contest, this will be a registration date only, and we're going to have a couple more registration dates. Give those dancers an opportunity to build so we can make this thing big, as well as to, more time to practice. So we have a $1,000 Steppers contest, which is a part of our fundraiser. That's Friday, February 3rd, this Friday, at the Grand Ballroom Chicago, located at 6351 South Cottage Grove. Phone number. For more information, dial 773-449-8839. Again, the number is 773-449-8839. Brother L.A., so we will have food, raffle prizes. Vendors are welcome, so if you want to get a vendor table, we do have a couple left. Birthdays, anniversary of the celebrations, welcome. Call for the donation asking amount for those tables to help us build and to refund. I wanted to share that, as well as the opportunity to learn Spanish. So each adult who comes in with a ticket is going to sponsor. You're looked at as a sponsor for young people to take 30 days, that's twice a week for a month, I'm giving for the Spanish and English literacy. So your $15, $20, whatever your discount rate is, tickets are $15, $20 at the door, 2 for $25 on sale right now. So 773-449-8839. And we honor you as well, Brother L.A. So we still need a short bio, just because I've shared with the young people. And CJ is right here. He's one of our builders. So they've learned a lot about you through me, but I want them to also have a way. So I'm wondering, would you accept the page on the blog site, RebaLaMaestra.com? Then that way they could see some of other things that you've done, because I've sent link clips to the podcast and things like that. But certainly we want them to know of your legacy as well.
All right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And any other announcements?
No, not at this time. Lil Johnny Ministries is our fiscal agent. We have a full curriculum being offered. This is what we use, but it'll be for available. The workbooks are $25 each for Lil Johnny student workbook, and it's a conflict resolution, and I say conflict avoidance curriculum, because as you learn self-accountability, you will thus circumvent violence. So that's pretty much about it. Yeah, we're taking donations as well for different.
Question: do you know the distinction between the convenience store, the family-owned convenience store, and the George Floyd family?
You said the difference between the convenience.
Might come to you.
Pardon me?
Do you know the distinction between the family who owns the store where George Floyd frequented versus what's the major distinction between his family, George Floyd's, and I'm gonna say the Akbar family, who owns the convenience store where George Floyd was last purchased something.
What is the distinction besides nationality or?
Yeah, besides nationality. I'm gonna say economic.
Okay, well, I don't know much about Mr. Floyd's family. It did come across. I just got an inclination. It just seemed that because that store, it was looked at actually as just, I won't say a hangout spot, but everybody was, you know, from the different interviews and the comments from people in that community, they felt that was like a family or community store, basically for them. But accusing Mr. Floyd of stealing or being fraudulent with the counterfeit bill, the thing is, we tend to deal with, we actually are approached in a different mannerism due to our ethnicity. And that's one thing that I just felt that not only in the sphere, but just learning of the assault that occurred before George Floyd was assaulted and thus murdered. He was not treated fairly. Because I've actually gotten, someone gave me a counterfeit bill before, and I didn't realize it was counterfeit until I was ready to spend it. So the clerk told me, thank God, you know, I had other money, but it was a $5 bill back then. But a lot of times, I'm not saying that everything is all innocent per se, but you still, if you make a mistake or you're in a situation, I just feel that we should be treated and handled differently. No one other than a black would have been floored like that, kneed upon the neck and treated like that for any accusation or concerns of police looking into a situation. So he was criminalized before he even left the store. So that's my distinction so far.
Okay. Well, anybody else? Any got 619-768-2945, press 1 if you got any spec guesses on it. Now I'm going to take the balling on Baltimore. Here's what I'm looking at. Number one, because you can sort of, is to me it's more like socioeconomic, not race. Number one, as they mentioned in Ballin' on Baltic, the foreign family who owned that store, third generation, as they noted in Ballin' on Baltic, and many little convenience stores or gas stations around the country, the store owners, and they're typically family-based businesses. The police can come in and get as much coffee as they want to drink, and let's throw in some donuts too, around the clock, all shifts, 24/7, 365. So these store owners, which are family-based businesses, that's family wealth. Number one, they have a family business. And when you have a family business, that is harnessing the family's wealth into individual paychecks of every member of the family. That's number one. Number two is coffee is just flavored water. So the policemen that run that beat, and in shifts, because you got three shifts, typically, 365, they can come in and they can drink as much coffee as they want, eat donuts or what have you. And you have that family that's building, that has built social capital. So, and now you also have black families that do this. This is what I'm saying. It's not so much race. I think it's socioeconomic, because you have black folks that run convenience stores. I have not heard of one story in the mainstream media where, because once again, there are black folks on the family level that own liquor stores. There are black folks on a family level that own convenience stores and gas stations, but I have not heard of not one one black family who has had a violent incident or run-in with the police. Not one. So is it race or is it socioeconomics? So they have social capital. And with carryouts, is the statistic that I threw out there, the average little carryout in the hood takes in over $1 million a year selling Chinese food. They also sell some food that, you know, the indigenous people in those neighborhoods like, you know, wings. You know how you like your wings and everything. Matter of fact, in some places I've had to tell them, but I had to be specific when placing my order. Because some people automatically, I don't like hot sauce and tobacco sauce. Can't stand it. I don't even like the sight of it. But in some places, they automatically put that on there. That's why I had to spell it out. No, just salt and pepper only. I had to spell it out. It depends on where I'm at. I had to spell it out that way. But this is an interesting factoid that ties into Claude Anderson. Now, once again, I have not heard of not, because they're all black folks who own liquor stores. They're all black folks who own convenience stores. In Detroit, they're called party stores. But I have not heard of one black merchant who owns a convenience store, gas station, mini mart, not one who has had a violent run-in with the police. Just food for thought. Let's see. We got another caller here. 773-368. Your mic is open.
Yeah, good morning, Ellie.
Good morning, Ellie.
Just to respond to your question briefly, the difference between the store owner and someone else. You've asked the question. I won't use the word culture. I said third generation. And you can't create that with a video. That's taught from the cradle. And if you take any of those cultures where they teach their children, you find those kind of patterns. But when you look at what is the pattern in the black community, African-American descendants, you find that ours has been pretty much that of a consumer. And until that's changed from the children, I mentioned you before about junior achievement, to teach it in elementary school. And then you say monopoly and cash flow and various other things. That's what's missing in our community. We don't have that financial literacy that other cultures have. And it has to be taught. It's not going to get picked up overnight sleeping or something. And it's missing. And I thank you for your show, because I believe that's where we are headed toward. Actually, at some point, some generation is going to pick this up. If we don't teach it, the pattern that we see is going to continue. We're just going to continue to be consumers. And as I came in late on the recording, as the gentleman was saying, there are some principles that have to be practiced. And if you don't follow those laws, those principles, you're just going to keep getting the same failure results that we see. So, yeah, quite a difference. And we need to recognize and say that third generation family store. And, again, you find some of those patterns with us. I think we talked about one of the most common pattern film director, mortician, you find black families pretty much still on there. But you got it. So looking forward to this monopoly and other stuff that you're talking about. Thank you for giving me share. Thank you.
And thank you for your feedback, Delmar. Now, Delmar, give us your website because you have a number of blog talks that you have recorded, so which are current. So, how can they listen to those podcasts?
Okay, we at Del Mar, D E L M A R, America. That's with two A's. It's A A M E R I C A dot us. Del Mar America dot us. And if anyone want to kind of prep themselves for what we're going to be talking about Friday, Lord willing, I think about the third from the top. I had a lot of on-demand. Third one I talk about Family Chapter, just kind of an overview. So get some idea of what we want to share a little bit more about Friday. Check that out. That's Del Mar America, and the difference is America is spelled with two A's. Dot us on the Man Podcast.
Okay.
Thanks,
now let me ask both you and Reba this. Now George Floyd, let's say because he worked jobs and everything. George Floyd, let's say he had a 9-to-5 job. Let's say he had two jobs. All right, but he was working with somebody else. Now with the store owner. Of that last place where George Floyd had visited as a consumer, that was third generation, as you just mentioned, Delmar. Now, in a convenience store, with either one of you to answer, or you both can answer. How many? And once again, and Delmar brought this up. Family capital, turning family wealth into paychecks. All right, so now with the store owner being blood related, third generation, now George Floyd, let's say, was working two jobs, 16 hours a day for two paychecks. I don't know, but I'm just putting that out there because a lot of us have worked two jobs and the two paychecks to make ends meet. But within that convenience store, and we've all been convenience stores, how many items do you think that convenience store sold? I mean, cigarettes, ice cream, bread. How many items do you think was in that store?
Thousands.
Or the average convenience store that you walked inside of?
Thousands. And by the way, one I visited recently, Arab or somebody, wasn't us, but they had designed that store where every corner up to the ceiling, there were products, wall to wall. There was no space that did not have some product that they were marketing. I mean, that was drawn up on paper. That wasn't just something they did. You could see by design that store was capacity out, packed out. And again, everything that neighborhood would have was in that store. And the thing that was so noticeable about it, direct across the street, was this huge black church building with a fence around it. And I bet they didn't own nothing in that store.
Now, Delmar, I'm glad you brought that up. And I said, you did your homework. I was thinking hundreds, but you were right. I'm reading right now that, and this is on average, people, because they stock fresh fruit and fresh meat and carry upwards of 5,000 items. That's 500. That's 5,000 potential paychecks. Because I know a lot of convenience stores I'll go into side of. If I just wanted a stamp, one, they'll sell it to me. If I wanted to sell, if I wanted to get an envelope, they'll sell me just one single envelope.
Yep.
I don't smoke anything, but I've had people that I vibe with. We all have. That you go into a convenience store, look, man, all I want, I don't have enough for a pack. How much is one cigarette? Okay. Or one bottle of a can of beer, one loaf of bread. I mean, so each one of those, you might pay 50 cents for, I don't know, whatever they're selling stamps, single bucks, like stamps for the convenience store, I don't know. But that's a paycheck. So here's George Floyd, or the average American, that you're working 16 hours a day for two paychecks. You don't get to see your family as much as you want and all this, that, or the other. Well, the Chan or the Yee family or the Akbar family, they've got 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 paychecks sitting up in that convenience store. Notice another thing. How many of those merchants live in those same neighborhoods? They typically live somewhere else.
Most of none, that's right.
Yeah.
They put their money where they want to grow it. They invest their money.
Right. Right. So.
And here's the thing about the 16-hour workday, L.A., as long as that money is being spent, I don't care how much is being earned, if it's all being spent as a consumer, it'll never create wealth.
Well, yeah, you're right about that. You're right about that.
But the convenience store, what you find with the convenience store, and this is what I love about Robert Kiyosaki, is that when he talks about how that, again, some of that money, that cash flow, doesn't have to be profit, but they take it and they use some of it to invest to create wealth while it's passing
right
through there. And that 16-hour workday, if it doesn't happen, doesn't matter how much money, still going to be.
Right. And that, you know what, that I'm glad you just bought the 16-hour workday. So you take the George Floyd, that merchant with the, now I had to look up his name for this week, the family that owned the store. So let's say they got 5,000 items in that store, which means, 5,000 paychecks. All right. And they put in, and let's say they're open. Well, some of them open 24/7.
Yep.
But they can just be open for, let's say, just the convenience store, let's say bare minimum 12 hours, half a day.
7 days a week.
No.
7 days a week.
7 days a week. Okay.
Yep.
So, if you got a 9-to-5 that pays you, you got two of them. So you're getting paycheck. You're getting four paychecks a month. Whereas, how many paychecks are they getting by the hour? We really need to start thinking in a different manner. We can try to legislate. You're not going to legislate this into existence. This is something that we have to, with side hustles or whatever you call it these days, we need to do the same thing.
Well, get back to the principle about the monopoly. And again, what you said, the gentleman that was speaking about is, I think, grandfather. Those principles are as old as the Bible.
Right.
And what to buy and what not to buy, what to sell, those are the same principles that work today. And if it's not taught, it's not practiced.
Right. Absolutely right. And they're taught that because, like I say, most of those businesses are family-based businesses. They just get passed down from one generation to the next. But they're training their children, because generational wealth starts at the crib, the cradle. That's where it starts, the education of it. And they grow up in the business. They grow up in the business. All right. Well, thank you, Delmar. Thank you, Reba. We're going to call it in for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Everyone have a good rest of the day.